you're literally holding the biggest purse in drag racing history for door slammers.
It's kind of like a dream, kind of like you're living in a dream. We've been fast and we've won races, but you win that race, you know, when you pull in the stadium lane, we won his ass. He puts a big bullseye on you. Going into the World Series, you go out there and you win the race. You're living a fantasy land because that race puts you on the Mount Rushmore of Pro Modified for you're there. They can't take it away from you, so it's huge.
A special guest, we have Steve King, who is the winner of the 2025 World Series of Pro Mod. What's up, guys? Welcome to the Eat Sleep Race podcast. Today, we have a special guest. We have Steve King, who is the winner of the 2025 World Series of Pro Mod. My co-host today is Brian ESR. Steve, welcome to the Eat Sleep Race podcast.
Man, thanks for having us up here. We've been doing a few of these, and this is a pretty big one, so we're happy to be here.
Well, thank you for coming from Virginia, because we're recording in New Jersey right now. You just drove how many hours to come on the podcast?
Five-hour trip.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, man. We try to help, and it helps us, too. So
that's awesome.
Let's get right into it. You know, let's get the viewers acquainted with you. For people that don't know who you are, you know, I just said you're a drag racer. You won World Series of Pro Mod, but let's go all the way back. How did you get into drag racing?
Well, you know, even when I was young, even like young guy in school, no driver's license, my brother had some hot rod cars and that grew upon me. And as you go along, you get your driver's license and ended up with like I think my first real car was like a Mustang, like a 71 Mustang. And you work on a little bit and you move on. I finally figured out I wasn't a Ford guy, so I got me a Camaro. A 67 Camaro with a 3-speed and a 6-cylinder in it.
Okay.
In school, right? So you start in there and then you slowly start working on them. The need for speed, you know, sitting in class, and this is real stuff, sitting in class with hot rod magazines, looking at that stuff in English class and getting in trouble, a little bit in trouble in school, and slowly getting into that type of thing with the Camaro. And the next thing you know, I get a big block Chevy and plug that into the program, and you just each phase you keep getting faster. You want to go faster, faster and more. So you along the way, being young, you learn things to do and not to do and work your way forward. So put the big block in it, you know, a little bit of street racing. Don't like to say that, but back in the 80s, you know, I'm a little older guy, but in the 80s, that's where we started.
Right.
Street racing. Is it the right thing? Probably not, but we did do it. And those cars was not fast enough. Wasn't fast enough for me, wasn't fast enough. So my father-in-law was racing at some local tracks and being there bracket racing and that type of thing. So I traded that car in and got a Super Comp Camaro, like a 89 IROC type deal. It ran fairly fast, 550s in the eighth. Okay. At the time was fairly fast, right? And as we went along, put nitrous on it, go faster, faster. And I didn't do very well bracket racing because I never wanted to let off the throttle. I always wanted to run it out the back, right? You don't want to whop the throttle when you're in front. You want to win as much as you can. So
right.
I started going to some of these NMCA, NSCA races, watching them, and had a local guy who's now my crew chief, but anyway, he's a local guy, Jeff Miller, who I'd always watch on these videos with this blower car. Camaro had a big blower on it, and I'd go to these races, and these guys would, when that car started up, everybody in the stands would turn and look at them. And when they come to the starting line, those were the cars I wanted to watch. I'm like, I got to get me one of these things. So I sold everything I had. I sold all my stuff, and I ended up with a Dodge Viper. I found this thing in the back of National Dragster. I'm like, I'm not really a Mopar guy, but this is the coolest car I've ever seen. This is going to, I was young and kind of thought, oh, if I get this, I can go out and get all these sponsors. And, well, I realized it didn't really happen that way, but I had to fund it.
Right.
And very interestingly, I did my homework. I talking to all these guys, including Jeff, and he didn't even know me then, but I was talking to him, asking questions, trying to figure out what I had to do to win. And I wasn't just coming to win. I wanted to kill them. So they're like, if you buy a Brad Anderson Hemi, you're going to destroy this class. So the light went off. I'm like, I go home. I called. first person to answer the phone at BAE is Brad Anderson, which never talked to the man since. But the very first phone call to Brad Anderson, he answered. And I told him what I want to do. He said, oh, you buy one of these engines, you'll go out there and destroy the class. Like, all right, send me the price list. And from there, I get it all. And I'm a young guy. I'm not a gearhead. I'm used to big block Chevy stuff. And all this nice billet aluminum stuff shows up in all these boxes. And it's pretty. And I got this Dodge Viper sitting there. And to be honest with you, I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue what I'm doing. I'm like, I'm putting this thing together. So I got the car at a local chassis shop. And he knew I didn't know what I was doing. I'm pulling cylinder heads out, putting them together, trying to put them together, let's put it per se. And he calls Jeff Miller, and Jeff comes up, and he doesn't know me. He just comes in. He just thought I was a guy that didn't have a lot of stuff, and he just wanted to see what was going on. And he had just gotten out of racing. And he shows up. He walks up. I just got this little 26-foot trailer with all this Brad Anderson Hemi stuff in it. He opens up the boxes and his eyes get like big. He's like, what are you going to do with all that? I said, I don't know. I'm going to Orlando World Street National. I'm kicking everybody's ass. That's what I bought it for. And, you know, he came on board and helped. And I didn't know you had to have a license. I'm like, he said, you ever driven one of these cars for him? I'm like, nope. I drove a super comp car. He said, well, that ain't a super comp car. So I was getting in over my head. I was. And Jeff stepped in, and I ended up, he drove the first season. So that, just saying that, I wasn't expecting that. That's not how I thought it would turn out. But he drove, and he was learning to become a crew chief. And I was learning to drive along that side of things.
Oh, he was driving your car.
He drove my car.
Oh, okay.
The Viper. He drove that car. And thank goodness it actually worked out for the greatest point. I didn't think it was so great when I first did it, because I'm like, well, I want to drive. But that learning process for that first season was huge for me, to go out there, and he would race. We'd go to NMCA races and he would race, and we'd stay over and I'd make a lap or two just getting some seat time.
After the race events is over.
Yes, correct. And he worked with me, because driving a super comp bracket style car compared to you getting one of these supercharged animals, is there's no comparison. I mean, you move the throttle blades a eighth of an inch and these blower motors just go crazy.
Yeah.
And I think we ran 640s back then, 630s in a quarter, which in today's standards seems like that's slow and bracket, but then it was really, really fast. So we ran a few seasons. I took over the driving duties, and I wasn't a great driver. I wasn't. And I worked my way through it, because you have to learn. I don't think you can just set your butt in one of these cars and just come out and you're a badass. I don't think you can. I think it takes some laps.
What does it take to drive a pro mod? Like, what are some of the skills? Like, what did you learn over those years that he was racing your car that helped you become a better driver?
Well, just watching what it took, number one, to run the car, the amount of work behind the scenes compared to bracket racing, where we didn't take the car out the trailer usually too much unless we was racing. But number two, driving the car, the G-forces, and I never forget this, and Jeff still makes fun of me today. The first time I let the clutch out and I drove it down through there and got through first low gear, I get it out to the top of the gear, and back then we ran clutches, and when the clutch arms come in and grabbed hold of the motor and really start accelerating, I let off the throttle, and we come back around the pit, and Jeff said, what happened? He's like, why'd you let off? The car's straight. It was going down the track. I said, all I could think of was Star Trek on TV when the warp speed kicks in and everything, because your mind can't keep up with what's going on the racetrack.
Right.
So I think that's a big part of driving the car. You have to keep up with the car. You get some new guys in the car and the crew chiefs will say, hey, you're behind. You're behind the car. That's because the car is at 200 feet and your mind's still at 100. And I think that's a big, big thing for drivers as they get in there. They think they have to go to the finish line the first go-around or second go-around. I think you have to get accustomed to the G-forces, the things, everything going on. I mean, now we drive, and we can kind of, not that we do, but you can see stuff going on, you know, because you get accustomed to it.
Right.
Of how fast and what's going on around you. So that's a big thing. And as well, you're feeling what's going on in the car. I call it setting your butt in the seat, and you're driving it, but you're feeling what's going on, whether the tire's spinning, you got too much wheel speed, or if you have tire shaking, it shakes the crap out of you. Just these cars are so meticulous of you miss one wrong thing, they're not going down the racetrack.
Do you think there's a way you can kind of develop or hone those skills off the track, or you think it's only seat time that'll do it? You know what I mean? Like are there things you can do to help develop your racing skills when you're not racing?
I mean reaction time, you know, we have practice trees, we set that type of stuff up, and as the car has gotten faster, that's came very important, where before if you had a lot of power, you didn't have to be killer on a tree. But as far as driving, I really think it's just seat time and making laps, you know, just make a hit and come back around and come back up and just getting accustomed to it. I mean, there's some young guys that have come in and done really well, but I'm sure there's been some serious testing going on behind the scenes that, you know, you don't see at the race. He right. rents the track and goes out there, and they test for 2 or 3 days at a time, and they just lap after lap after lap and really get accustomed to what's going on in the race car.
Sounds kind of costly.
Very. It is. And these cars are expensive, you know. And that's one reason, you know, from the Viper days, I'll go back to that car, but Jeff learned to be a crew chief, if we really knew what he was doing, we'd have been really fast early. But learning that is a learning process.
Mm-hmm.
As far as fuel systems and how to set the car up, and we might have the fuel system right, and then the car might not be right, or the gear ratios might not be right. So there's a lot, if you're trying to do it all yourself as a package deal, there's a lot of learning and cost that goes along with that learning. And the class kept speeding up. Every year it got faster and faster and faster, and we started seeing guys bring in Alan Johnson. I'm like, well, these guys are bringing these guys in. So I call Randy Anderson. I bring him in, Brad Anderson's son, to help. And the class just keeps escalating. After the Viper, I'm like, well, these guys are all building new cars, and I feel like we're behind. So I called Jerry Haas, and I built a new Camaro. I was doing a Viper, but we couldn't get a body, and kind of drug on. I'm like, well, what can you build me right now? And he had just built Brad Anderson a Camaro. So I said, well, I'll take one of those. I want a new car. I want new pipe. I want to try to run. You're trying to keep up with the guys that's running up front.
Right.
And that's what we was trying to do. And we built the whole deal, and we did well with that car. It was a 68 Camaro, and Jerry Haas, and same thing, blower stuff. And NMCA, NSCA kept going, and that stuff just slowly just turned right into pro mod, even though it was called street car racing. We had some mufflers and a horn on it, but in reality, it was a pro mod. And that's when Gene Pilot shows up, because we can't keep up. To be honest, me and Jeff both were putting a lot of money in, and the guys just kept more, going,
taking it to the next level.
Next level, correct. And Jeff came to me, and he's like, Steve, I think we're going to have to pull the plug. I'm like, pull the plug? I don't want to hear that, you know? But I understand both sides, the financial side as well.
What was it, because the finances that he was saying you might have to pull the plug? Like, it was getting too costly?
He's like, you know, I don't want to race for second place. I don't want to race for fifth place. You know, we can run with them, but can we go out here and blow it up every run like they're doing?
Yeah.
Can we take the, you know, we was using a lot of stuff more than we should have been, like connecting rods and stuff like that. Like, you need to change them. If you don't hurt the motor, you need to change them after so many runs. Everybody's different. Some guys are 20 runs, some guys are 30.
Mm-hmm.
But we was running them 45 runs because I didn't want to buy new connecting rods.
Right.
So then you start into the parts attrition, as we call it, and more money. You run the parts longer, well, when it does break, and then it costs you more to fix it. So Jeff's like, I think I'm going to step back a little bit. I'm like, well, I don't want to quit racing. I'll sell everything I got to races. Like, I'm like a junkie trying to race. And anyway, a friend of ours who raced with us, and we helped some, we told him, hey, we might be thinking about selling this thing. And along the way, He brings Gene Pilot to the racetrack, who was looking to get into racing. And he's like, and you, when you first talk to someone, you don't know how interested they are in getting involved or not. You just don't know. You don't know who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And so we came to terms, and we raced. And the first thing he asked us, I said, Gene, if you buy the car, you're buying a top five car. He's like, top five? Why would I buy a top five car? I don't race for that. I race for number one. I'm like, well, if you buy the car, I said, I don't like blowing smoke up your ass. I'm being honest, this is a top five car, but not a top one car or two. And he came to us after the race. I actually red lighted. And after the race, he came to us and he said, I want to purchase the car, but I want you to write down on this notebook paper here what we need to be a top one car. He said, and I don't stutter, I don't say two, a top one car. And I'm like, no way, this guy's out of his mind. And we wrote some stuff down, and he sent it. He said, it will be at your shop next week. Can you have it ready in a week after that for the big 25,000 to win race at Bud's Creek for the Northeast? I said, yeah, if it's there, we'll have it together.
Wow.
And in between that we got John.
Did he put a budget on it?
Nope. No budget.
Blank checkbook.
He wants a win. And it's not about the money. It's just about, hey, I want to win. And in the process of that, Gene had been involved with John Salemi's guys for a while on another project.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, don't tell John that I bought this car. He said, just call him and fly him in and get him. So we call him and we purchase the stuff from John that we need and say, John, we need some help. And we go to that race and we win 25,000, win the race. And it's like Gene just, you know, you done hit him. And he's like, oh man, that was easy.
Right.
And that's what he, you know, and we win a couple more races and we come out the following year. They had changed the rules some in the Northeast.
You were driving.
I was driving. Before I get in, I'll get into a little something here that's actually funny as hell. Gene bought the car with intentions to drive. So we won that race.
Like you bought the Viper.
Yes, correct. And I won the race, and he stayed over on Sunday to drive. And we had some fumes in the car all year. I'd been driving with these fumes, and I didn't have fresh air then, and I just held my breath sometimes and made it work. Gene drove the car one rip. He goes on the two-step, and I think he was nervous, and he lets off the button and lets off the throttle, and then he hits the throttle, and anyway, the fumes get him. He stops on the racetrack, and he crawls out, and my son gets in the car, and Gene's like, or my son asked, he said, what's wrong, Gene? The fumes got me. He said, I think you're a sissy. He said, my dad's been driving it like that all year. You need to drive it. So Gene comes back to starting line. He said, I made up my mind. You drive the car. You're a crazy son of a bitch. You drive. And he said, I'm going to be an owner. And that's how Gene Pilot got involved with us.
What year was that?
That was 2017.
Okay. So that was actually going to be one of my questions, because you kept saying he bought the car, but it was like part of the racing program. So
yes.
I was trying to figure out how that worked exactly. So he wound up becoming owner.
Yep.
And you were racing his car.
Yep. We was racing his car. And originally he had planned on driving, like I said. And then that one run did him in, and he's like, I'm done with that. That's not getting behind that bomb. And, you know, the next year they changed a bunch of rules, and I'm like, Gene, man, this new blower they're letting in, I don't think we can run with them. They make so much power. We don't have one. He said, oh, I got two of them new in the box at the house. I'm like, what? I don't know what.
He came ready to play.
Yeah, he said, oh, I had them for the other project. I just didn't tell nobody.
Why do you think Gene chose Pro Mod versus any other class?
Just the excitement.
So going a little backwards here, when you had your original car and then you got the Viper, was your career always in automotive, or what were you doing to support your racing habit?
No, we actually do construction work, site development, infrastructure type work, build a few houses. At that time, I didn't. I was just doing construction work and just actually had left my father's business and went in business for myself and was trying to grow that as well. And that's what we do.
That's what I noticed, you know, a majority of the trailers at World Series of Pro Mod, that the greater majority of the racers are self-funded through, you know, mainly construction businesses. And it's actually kind of funny because a couple of our import guys, that was kind of like, man, I got to own a construction business because look at all these guys.
It really is. There's a lot of almost, I would say almost every pro mod team out there is a self-funded for the most part. There's some stuff in the NHRA going on that may not, maybe, you know, there's guys from other countries bringing some money in, but in PDRA, that's the big thing with pro mod. They're self-made guys that they're spending their money. They're to get out there and enjoy this deal that we're all doing. And it's work. The pro mod thing is work, but you're not working at home on what you do every day. So
right.
get you out of that.
My question, based off some of the stuff you said earlier, was going to be, what does it take to build a good racing team? You said you wound up bringing in a lot of these guys. You know, did you like handpick them? Did they have certain skills? Like what does it take to build a good team?
We raced early on with a lot of family, guys within my family, my son, Jeff's son, myself, and guys that raced with us a long time. But as the team's grown and the sport has grown, you start having to bring in guys like John Salemi, and there's some other guys out there that do this for a living. That's what they do. They live, eat, sleep, drag racing, pro modifieds. That's what they do, where me and Jeff have to go home and run a loader or dozer, move dirt, build houses, whatever, in order to fund it. They go home, work on the, or they go to the racetrack and test, or they're on the engine dyno testing. So those are the guys, as the sport has grown, if you don't bring those guys in, you're always going to be behind slightly, because they're making way more laps than you. They're finding more power than you can find. You can buy the package, but are you getting what they got? You know, we don't have the time at home to do the R&D, basically. So you have to bring those type of guys in, and along with what Gene has done, create a business plan. Even though it's racing, it's a business plan. Hey, I need this guy involved. We need this guy. So that's really where the sport of pro mod has gone.
Let's talk Drag Illustrated Winter Yes. Series. You know, you got Snowbirds, you got U.S. Nationals, you got World Series of Pro Mod. Did you race all of the races?
Yep, we did all three of the Winter Series with Wes and those guys. And, you know, this, the baddest cars in the world come down there for the three races, with the biggest one being the World Series at the end of that deal. But, you know, he took what I say is a perfect storm of guys going down there in the winter and testing. And there was always one or two races at Bradenton, and a lot of the guys would pick one or the other and not right. do them both. And that's what we did. We'd always go down early January and give us a little time at the end of the year to try to get your program better and mm-hmm. focus on work. Well, pro modifieds got to the point you can't take off now. If not, you're going to be behind because everyone else is there testing or right. running. And so Wes took that deal. Him and Victor took that winter deal and turned it into the winter series, and it just blew up. It's, you know, the biggest thing in drag racing right now.
How much was that check?
The World Series race was 150 K. The first race, which is the Snowbirds, I think was 50 K to win. The second race was US Street Nationals, was 75,000 to win. So he puts the check out there for you, you know, for the guys to come. But
you say that nonchalantly, the 150K, but in reality, that's the biggest purse in door slammer drag race in history, and you want it.
Yep.
Walk us through the moment that you realize, like, you're literally holding the biggest purse in drag race in history for door slammers. Like, what is that?
It's totally unbelievable. It's kind of like a dream, kind of like you're living in a dream when this happens, because we knew we had a good car to go down there to the winter series. We ran well at all the races, just didn't get by that first round or like the second race. I had to run Mark Mickey, who's one of the baddest cars on the planet, and he goes out there and goes 56 against my 60. So I run third or fourth fastest pass of that whole session, and you're still going home. So right. going into the World Series, you go out there and you win the race, and it you're living a fantasy land. Because that race puts you on the Mount Rushmore of pro modified, for you're there. They can't take it away from you.
That's
so it's
right.
huge.
Did you really go to Disney World after?
I actually went before. So.
You did the pre-celebration.
Yes, yes.
I heard that on the interview. We're going to Disneyland after. I was like, wait, hold on. I got to find out. Did they really go? Yeah,
we went before. That's cool. So it was, that was a big, big winner circle
for sure. That's champion talk right there.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And
so here's a good question for you, because you mentioned at some point you had to throttle back a little bit because you didn't want to spend as much money at the events because you were pushing the cars too hard. When you go racing now, is it with the sole purpose to win and whatever breaks, breaks? Or do you have like a cutoff of like, we don't want to push the car too hard because we want to be able to test and get data and stuff like that?
Well, John Salemi and the G-Force guys and Mike Stawicki, who is our engine guy, they've given us a great package. So you can't leave anything on the table on any run from testing till the finals. It's just the way John runs the car and the other 80 cars at that race run their car. So you're on the edge every run. But do you go up there and worry if it breaks? You can't worry about it breaking. You can't, because the guy beside of you don't care.
Right.
So, and a lot of one small piece can cost you a big fortune. I mean, one valve breaks off, one something manufactured, whatever, just something small can be a big blow up. But no, you can't go up there thinking you're worried about if it's going to blow up. I mean, even Gene's huge. I mean, I've heard him go to John a couple of times. If it ain't running good enough, you need to blow it up, blow it up. But, I mean, John's not like, he's like, I don't need to blow it up. I just got to get my shit together and make the car perform the way it needs to perform.
What's some of the maintenance that you have to do, like, in between runs on, like, on an average race weekend?
Every run, when it comes back, the car is going over from front to rear. If nothing is broke on the car, to make sure there's nothing coming loose, broke, the valve covers come off mandatory every run to go through the valve train to make sure, because that's a very big portion of something there is coming loose or something that's going to be catastrophic.
Right.
Transmission is cooled every run to get the heat out of it. And underneath, like I say, we check four link bars, brake lines. We have a ritual the guys go through in the pit, and there's usually something else that is broke. I mean, if we burn a piston, it happens. Not as much. I mean, John's got a very good combination right now, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. And cylinder heads off, oil pan off. Track conditions play a big role in what we do between rounds. So if the track conditions change, we may have to go in and change gear ratios in the transmission. We may have to pull the drive unit and put a different torque converter in it.
It's that in-depth, just if the temperature changes?
Yep, just small changes, you know, and there's a lot of weight changing from front to rear on these cars. They have them balanced very, very specifically for conditions. So, I mean, we might be in the staging lanes and, you know, John may come up, hey, pull 5 or 10 off the front and put in the trunk, or take 10 out the trunk room. And we're up there like 4 pair back from running, and the guys are, I'm strapped in the car and they're jerking the front end off the car, you know, moving weight around, because that 5 pounds can make a difference of the car going down the track or not.
Right.
Are you adjusting the car and like the weight based on the track condition or who you're running against?
Track conditions.
You don't care who's next to you?
Don't care. John's going to try to make that car perform as best possible run every run by what lane and what track conditions. If there's someone over there, which World Series, there's somebody over there every run, you're not getting any, everybody's at their highest level, but that 5 pounds on every run makes a difference, depending on if the sun's out, cloud cover, nighttime sessions, all different track temperatures. There's a lot of different things that come into that, of how well the car is balanced according to the amount of traction on the racetrack or the amount of air. Like if the air is better, we're going to make more power. So all that plays into effect.
So bringing into the combination that you run, your Camaro, you're running blower turbo nitrous, and mm-hmm. that's one of the 4 power adders allowed in Pro Mod.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe the strengths and the quirks of your setup and why you think it was the right setup to take the win at World Series of Pro Mod?
Well, the screw blower, I call it the devil, because every place that thing goes, it sets records, and they, a lot of classes, it's banned. They don't like it, but in Pro Modified, the screw blower is kind of taken over. The Pro Chargers are fast. The nitrous guys, they always say they're behind a little bit, but they always seem to run pretty good. The top couple guys do. They may be a tick or two behind against the blower stuff now. It's like the blower stuff has advanced more than the nitrous stuff has advanced in the last few years. But personal preference, the screw blower is what we run. We would never change. If the rules got to the point that we had to change, I think Gene would quit. He just like, we're not, you know, we struggled a little bit early on at one point in the PDRA, and we're like, and those pro charge guys are hauling ass. Should we switch? And Gene's like, absolutely not. We're not changing shit. And, you know, and John and them bring a good package. They get the package together and they're out there, you know, with their cars very the same as ours. Melanie Salemi and us, both cars are identical G-Force race cars. So it gives John a world of information. When they make a pass, he can take their information and use it on what we're doing because both chassis are identical. Everything's supposed to be the same, but there's always some small differences. But for the most part, it gives him two cars to get information off of.
Yeah, we've heard that from other racers before about having matching setups, and you know the tuner will be on site and be like, okay, like we'll check out the data from your car and then apply it to the next person that's going up.
Correct. And you know, that's what it takes. Like John Slimming and them is their combo is the screw blower, so that's what we run. There's other guys out there that have pro chargers, and there might be a bunch of those, and they all do the same thing.
Do you think you guys winning with the screw blower combination has or will influence other teams to reconsider their setups?
No, I think a lot of the cars, if you look at the World Series of qualifying, everyone's within 500s, no matter what combination you have. So you really I don't think anyone really needs to change. That's just their preference of what they do. I don't think the Pro Charger has quite as much maintenance on the engine as we do. From what I see, I'm not involved in it. So seeing what I see, those guys, you got Jason Harris and those guys, sometimes I'll go over there drinking sweet tea and we got the cylinder head off the damn thing. But, you know, maybe they got their shit together more than we do, but I'm just using that as a point of reference that they would never change to a screw blower, and the screw blower guys most likely won't change to the Pro Charger side.
So you mentioned the other competitors. At World Series of Pro Mod, all the competitors are invite only.
Yes.
Over 80 cars competing in the field, which is a testament to say, because you mentioned that before, every car is within a very minimal gap of each other, that it is the baddest of the bad competing at that event. Where does that land for you, you know, even before the event? Does that have any effect on you versus you going to NHRA or PDRA event? Is the mindset different? Are you nervous?
I mean, it makes you, it's not a nervousness, but every run, you know, has to count. From Tuesday, World Series, we start testing on Tuesday. And if you miss a run, you're behind because the other cars are making that run. So you lost that information. And that could be the information you need come Saturday to win the race. It does. If you can make good runs on Tuesday and John will keep rolling that info in and just keep picking away at it, trying to pick it up a little bit more, pick it according to the conditions. And that's huge. It's huge. A lot of guys, some guys get there and they may have their stuff really together and they may not test till Thursday, but I really think that's a disadvantage. Because you got 83 guys there of the baddest guys in the entire world, and they're all making laps, and that's huge. So you cannot even back it down just a little bit. You got to, if you go up there and if you think the track will hold a 59, you better try to run a 59. If you go up there and the track will hold a 65, you got to try to run a 65, and it's really due to track conditions.
Have you ever had any close calls where it was like in between runs, like let's say you broke something and the crew was like, we got 2 minutes left to get this done? Have you ever had any close calls like that?
A lot. Like after second round of the World Series race, John comes over and says, I mean, I thought that everything was fine. He comes over and looks at the data and he said, we've been running this engine since Tuesday. Get it out, put the other one in. And like, I'm like, really? And the guys jump in, and all the G-Force guys come over as well, and I had to go to the chip draw. Matter of fact, I almost missed the chip draw. I had oil in my hands because I'm jerking stuff off too. I mean, yeah. I drive, but I don't get to just stand back and watch. So I'm helping, and me and Jess jump on the daggone cart and haul ass up there, and I reach in with holy hand and grab my chip, and who do we got? Eric Anders, you know, and like, okay, I got to go. See y'all. And we go back, and I get back, and the G-Force guys and my guys, the new engine's already in it. They're like, get in. We're getting ready to start it up.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
Wasting no time.
Yeah, 35 minutes. Those guys really, really worked hard. So, yeah, it's a common thing. And not just our team. A lot of the pro mod guys have to do that.
Right.
The very next run, we beat Erica, and the very next run, same thing, burn a piston on a brand new engine, trying to make it run, and just it happens. It's part of the gig. And once again, we run to the chip draw, come back, they've got the cylinder head off, and jam a piston down in it, and it's ready to go back. And even in the finals, Stevie had to have a little bit of time, you know. So it's very common practice to be thrashing.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree that the chip draw ladder on race day was chaos?
It makes the race way more interesting, in my opinion. You can win, we won from the 30th position. So we didn't have to run the number 3 qualifier. You could run the number 32 qualifier just by reaching in the bag.
Right.
But all 32 cars are fast, so I don't know if it's an advantage or not, but it you don't know who you have the next round every time. So you go up there, and it really brings a lot of eyes onto that deal each round, who you got, who. I think that deal really, really makes that race interesting.
In that manner of, you know, not finding out who you're going up against up until you draw your chip, is that, what effect does it have on you when you find out who you're racing against? Like when you see, like, I just drew up Erica Anders, does it faze you?
Well, I mean, at that race, everyone's a world champ and everyone's a badass. So you just, who am I going to get? But then like that time when I pulled Erica out, I'm like, we all know she's a certified badass, period. Right. I mean, she does what she does, and you're like, well, I better go back here and get a Mountain Dew, and because I'm going to have to get up on the wheel here. And that's what you do. I mean, all the guys are good, but when
no changes to the car, just a change in the mindset.
Right. And
Mountain Dew in the system.
It does. You have to have a mindset of who's over there. But that World Series race, it's forced me to sit at home and practice because I've got to get better. I've relied on power we've had a lot of power, and I didn't. With Jeff, I always told him, even with Gene, I'm like, I'll be there when I need to be there. But now everyone's fast. Like, I could get away with not being so good the first round or second round, but the car would bail me out. But then come the semis or the final, I'd step up and be 10 on the tree or whatever.
Right.
Well, you can't have that mindset anymore. You can't. So the last 2 or 3 years, it's really forced you as a driver to buckle down, and you need to try to be 20 or better on the tree, because the rest of the field is going to be. And that's what it's coming to.
So you're very lucky because you have pure confidence in the car and the mechanics behind it, that your job now is just confidently cutting the tree.
I have to be on the tree. I mean, they're on me. Even the first PDRA race, Jeff's on me. Oh, man, make sure that glove. We're trying to do some stuff with the glove so I can get a better feel for the button, and just trying to have a better average reaction time. Not have the mentality to roll up there and say, well, I'll be good when I need to be good, because mm-hmm. that's no good no more. So even in testing, I'm trying to saw the tree down and get that part dialed in, because right now the car is absolutely killer. I mean, that G-Force car is just right down the middle every run. It's so easy to drive compared to some of the other cars we've had. I don't know what John them's done to it, but it's just like driving a Cadillac down through there. It's just smooth as silk right in the middle of the racetrack.
So the Star Wars fear is no longer a thing.
No, I'm good on that. I can kind of look over and see people in the stands now, because your mind catches up to the racetrack.
That's great.
In those few seconds, you're just like, I know that guy.
You really do. You'd be surprised. They ask me, I mean, when you're talking, they said, what happened? I'm like, well, it went out there and felt like the wheel speed was slow, and then the power come in, it picks the front end up. And every run I'd tell them, like, Well, Stevie was in front of me at the 60 foot because I can see him because the wheels are in there. What else are you going to do? Just, you know what I mean? Wheels are up and the car runs so good in the middle. I'm already peeking over. Like a lot of the guys, I know they do. You know, you come off the button, you're already peeking to see if, because you can tell in the first 60 foot if they treed you or not.
Right.
So you're already like, oh man, he's out in front of me. And that's what I said in the finals. I mean, I probably said a few other things about that, about 60 foot, but I'm like, come on, baby, bail me out. And so, yeah, that's, you just get comfortable, I call it, in the seat.
You have to be mechanically inclined to race in general, but more specifically pro mod. You think you need to be mechanically inclined to know what the car is doing? Because you mentioned earlier, you know, you can feel the car, you can feel what changes need to be made, you specifically, but do you think every racer needs to know that?
They should. The more feedback the driver can give the crew chief, although he's going to go in and pull it up on the data recorder, and he's going to confirm what you're saying or come out and say, hey, man, you didn't, that it wasn't too slow, it was too fast. Or he might tell you something like that because that's happened. The data may say different than what my butt says. But there is some guys, you know, some guys, whether they're mechanic inclined, some guys just drive. They don't touch the car. I mean, there's certain a couple, but for the most part, these guys are all hands-on. Almost, I think 90, 95% of the pro mod field is hands-on with the car. And I think that does help too, as far as driving and giving feedback to the crew chief.
What was your quickest ET and speed of that weekend?
We went 62.6, 362.6 at 207, I believe it was. And I think that only qualified as 30th, you know, unbelievable. The World Series deal, or that whole winter series with five qualifiers, it's turned into, you can run really well. Like that 362 in that session during the daytime was probably a top 10 run, but we end up 30th on the qualifying sheet because
everyone's flying.
Thursday night, Friday night at night sessions, the cars pick up, and we had a couple little gremlins. We broke a little thing in the transmission that double shifted once. And so we went out and go 63 or something in the night session when we should have went 60 or 61. So you go to that big race with that many cars, it comes down to, you better run good in those night sessions if you want to qualify up in the field. I mean, we was really, really worried going into that last qualifier. We kept hearing the numbers. They was going faster and faster, and we was farther back in the field because we ran good in the fourth qualifier, but we kept seeing we was falling down the ladder. So, yeah.
Only 32 are making it out of
the 83. Only 32, and like, what are we going to do? And you're going to go up here and have to put it all on the line here on this run, and thank goodness we didn't, because it double shifted on us again in that fifth qualifier. So, and it didn't, it went 62, whatever, 7 or 8, but same way, it didn't pick up like we wanted it to.
Right.
So, yeah, it's nerve-wracking with that many cars. And
how does that number stack up to your best ET period?
I mean, we've been 58.
Okay.
We've been 58 with a little different transmission setup, and we've been 59 with this setup. So, according to the rules, the setups are all very, very similar in ETs. It's just a matter of conditions and you making the right knob turn on the race car from front to rear to make it do that.
How has racing changed over your time racing? How has it developed? You know, things like faster cars, better tech.
Obviously, the cars are all getting faster every year, but that's technology. And from when I first started racing to now, we used to have clutches, not as many electronics. The electronic side is the biggest thing, I think, that's really came into Pro Modified with Fuel Tech and some of these other companies that's came in, and they've just made the sport rise because they can control so much stuff on the race car. So, you know, that is the biggest thing that I think has changed the sport, that and automatic transmissions. You know, when I first started racing, if you had a blower car or a nitrous car, you had to run a clutch.
Mm-hmm.
And technology has gotten so good with what they're doing in these torque conversion stuff that I don't think there's a clutch car in the whole field. So if you don't have an automatic, and then, like I say, the electronics, that's the biggest thing. And the amount of budget it takes to run these cars is probably the biggest thing out of all of it.
How much do you think it costs, like, per race week, like a full race week for the program?
I mean, that's that's a difficult side of things.
Depends on how many things you're breaking.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it depends on, I mean, it could be a very, very expensive weekend if you break a connecting
rod. Give us
rod.
The high and the low then.
Right. I mean, it could be a very $50,000 weekend, maybe more.
Is that on the high end or the low end?
Yeah, that's probably, I mean, that's on the high end.
Including
the
staff.
Yeah, staff and everything. 50 to 60,000, say, if you have a very bad weekend. You know, on the low end, you're still fuel, like going to Bradenton and stuff, we have $4,000 in diesel fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting there and getting back. And then you still got the guys, you know, you got to get in, you got to food, drinks. I mean, we haven't even got into the race car yet.
Right, right.
You know, so yeah, every run costs money. You know, we put X amount of runs on every single thing on the race car, like the tires. You get 30 runs, just say 25. Everybody's different. Some guys mm-hmm. do less, some guys do more. Connecting rods, you get 20 runs. And if they don't break or you don't tear the stuff up, you better get them out the motor because you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
Just everything, every single part in that race car has a lifespan, and they've narrowed it down to, and they keep track of it. We have data in the trailer with every single part on that race car, how many runs is on it. And when it gets to that number, it's time
to spend some money.
Yeah. Time to change it out. Yep. And I think that's the biggest thing with the sport. Is that side of things where early on, we probably didn't quite do that as much.
Okay. You mentioned the diesel fuel just to go to and from. For the winter series, what was some of the preparation that was involved? Were you bringing the car back to Virginia? Or like what was that situation like?
We're very, very fortunate. G-Force and Mike Stawicki, those guys up there, and the whole G-Force staff, the car goes back to New York with those guys, back to their shop. So they have the engine shop right there. They have the chassis shop. They have everything there. So our deal with those guys is it goes back to them. The car gets completely gone over front to rear in between races. The engine gets gone through, converter, transmission. So when that car gets back to the shop, there's two or three guys up there on it every day.
So like the winter series after Snowbirds, it went right back.
Oh, every race. So we take the truck, and I have a truck, and Gene has a truck and trailer, and we have a motorhome. So because all of our guys stay in the motorhome, and the tractor and trailer carries parts, engines, toolboxes, scooters, you know, all that type of stuff. So we drive that, we set up, and John and them guys, when they get there, we roll our car out and roll it in our pit, and then we take care of it for the whole weekend. At the end of the weekend, whatever, if the car is in good shape, it goes back in their trailer along with whatever maintenance items need to go, whether it's rear ends or transmissions or, you know, whatever we've changed out through that race, we just goes right back in their trailer. And it makes it easier on us because we come home and go to work.
Right.
Right. That's what they do for a living. But then a lot of things people don't see that, they think, oh, well, hell, you don't have to do anything when you get home then. You don't have to do anything. Well, yeah, but if the generator's on the trailer, the generator's on the motorhomes, there's always something wrong with the motorhome. They're a rolling problem, whether right. you have new ones or not. You know, this last race, the generator took a dump. So I got the generator drug out trying to get it fixed before the next race. And it's not just the generator on the motorhome. You got the generator, like I say, on the trailer. You know, you could have flat tire. There's a magnitude of things that go behind the scenes of getting food prepped, drinks, coolers. Hey, get that stuff out. I mean, we've had them call us, hey, we want to change some stuff in the transmission. So I got to go out and get in the trailer and unload a bunch of stuff and dig out what we need, and I'll ship it up to those guys. And so there's a lot of stuff goes on behind the scenes that the average person think you just come home and park the rig and the next race you jump in and down the road you go. It's not really like that.
All right.
So that was actually a false assumption then, because being that the winter series events were, you know, only weeks apart, the general assumption was that cars come down for winter snowbirds and will leave the car there until World Series of Pro Mod.
Yeah.
Did everyone go back and come back?
Pretty much everyone will take their stuff back because there is the Pro Mod cars require so much maintenance. The engine, it's no longer like when I used to race early on. We wouldn't, if the motor was fine, we didn't really do that much. We'd pull the clutch out and surface it and check some stuff, We might put a valve spring or something on, but now it has to come apart because they are running these cars so hard. Every single thing in that engine has to be checked. Everything in that torque converter has to be checked. And that's what those guys do, you know, and they do it for a living, and they're always on to something, you know, something, the wheel's always turning up right? Yeah. And they might have something new in their head and
got to bring it back to the shop to get it done.
Yep.
So we're only not even halfway into the 2025 season. What are you looking forward to the rest of the year?
Well, we're trying to carry the momentum from the World Series race.
Started at a very high.
Very high. It's, you know, you win that race and you're up here. I mean, we've been fast and we've won races, but you win that race, it just puts you up there. And you, everyone's then like, you know, when you pull in the stage, you're like, hey, we want his ass. You know, and it does. It makes them want, it puts a big bullseye on you. And so we go to the first PDRA race, and we did make it to the semis. We was hoping to win, but we made the semis, and our teammate Melanie took us out in the semis. But we had a good showing, so that felt good for me. I didn't want people to think, hey, they went down there and got lucky and won this World Series race, and they didn't do nothing at the next race. So we're hoping to win some races in PDRA and try to win the championship in PDRA. That's Gene's goal.
So that's the next goal for the year.
Yes, try to win that championship and, you know, solidify that win at World Series to show that it wasn't a fluke.
Back it up.
Yep, correct.
You think Drag Illustrated needs to host more race events?
That's a good question. That'd be good if they do, but the market, there's so many places to race, right? Right now, he has that winter market. I think it's a perfect storm. Wintertime, all the other series stuff is done. So all the guys that run, whether you run in Australia, Midwest, California, everyone's going to come to Florida because the weather's good. Wintertime, nobody wants to be home in the winter. And Wes and Victor, it's just absolute perfect storm. So whether he does or not, I don't know. I mean, the big money payout, some of the guys are trying to do that even in some other races, but I don't think they'll draw the cars. I mean, they'll draw some, but are they going to draw 83? I don't think so.
You think it's tough to beat the way it is? Like, you think it's perfect right now?
I think it's the perfect storm, absolutely. Now, does he do stuff elsewhere? I mean, there's been some stuff on the internet where he's talking about doing some stuff overseas. I don't know, but I know those guys are very big. Like, the Australian guys are huge on it, wanting to.
Would that be something if he did do Australia? Would you guys put the car on the trailer and try to get it over there?
I don't think we would take the car because it takes so long to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Would I like to go? Yeah, hell yeah. I'd love to do it, you know, and Wes's deal is it would be big over there. You know, I don't know how many cars are in Australia, 20 or 30 probably, that could run it. They'd probably do a 16-car field, be my guess, but maybe they do 32. Maybe they get more than I know what's down there, but that's been on my bucket list. I like to go down there and drive. The old Camaro is actually in Australia right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they run it down there, and heck, maybe I can make a call.
Can I get in the seat?
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe you guys can build another car over there. So
right.
That way, you know, you don't have to ship it. Got that an identical one over there.
Yeah, that would be great. You know, that would be great. But the cars are so far out. I mean, they're 2 years out on cars right now.
It's really
crazy. Yeah, if you order a new car right now, it's like 2 years for most chassis guys.
Oh, wow.
But who knows, man? You know, the big thing right now in Pro Modified, you know, you can rent cars. You know, there's guys
we've
out.
We've heard of that, too.
Yeah, there's some rent. Like, you want to race this weekend? Pay the bill.
Right.
And, you know, you just fly in and drive. You don't even have to touch it. But I think that's where the sport has evolved to. Some guys don't work on the car or don't want to work on the car. They want to come and be involved in this, what I consider the biggest class in drag racing right now. And that's what they're doing. There's some of that going on. So, yeah, if I had the opportunity, I'd love to go over there and drive one.
So you mentioned the biggest class in drag racing, Pro Mod clearly exploding. NHRA has 12 stops. PDRA's Pro Boost is stacked. You have Randy Couture from the UFC coming in. What's your pitch to outsiders of why this class is the best show in drag racing right now?
Well, they're just so exciting. These cars are so violent. I mean, right now we have a very good car. It's going down the track, making it look, I say easy because it's been easy, but you don't know what you're getting every time. I mean, if you go up there and watch 32 pairs of these cars go down a track, every pair is just unbelievable to watch because you don't know.
Tenths of seconds of each other.
Yeah, they're just so close, and they go out there and shake. They're sideways. The front end's in the air. It's great for the spectators. It really is. These cars are the show to watch, and I think I don't know how anyone could not like watching Pro Modified.
And this is kind of like an open call to anyone who's got the checkbook for it, because you said you could rent the Pro Mod and jump in and just be part of the race if you wanted to. Well, if you get the invite, that is.
Right, you have to get that invite, correct.
So it is a possibility for outsiders who are like, I want a little bit better than what I'm racing right now. You're saying Pro Mod is what you need to try.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's some guys out there that probably are in the process of doing some of that. With this class exploding, especially the Winter Series and the World Series race in particular, there's so many of these guys, big name guys now, that's wanting to get involved in that.
Right.
And some of these teams have multiple cars, multiple, you know, tractor and trailers. So
might as well use them.
The equipment's there.
Right.
And they just need, you know, jump in and the water's fine. Come
and try the water on this side.
Yeah, come and get some.
I actually, because you said that, you know, it is a perfect storm. It is the off season. You know, it's kind of like if you got that itch, this is the right class to do it for, because the three events back to back during a time when people are usually have the what do they call that when you get seasonal depression.
Yes.
Right. It's like, all right, well, here's a good way to kick it.
Yep. The warm weather, out, you know, Southern Florida, the warm weather, the weather's usually good, although the one race was really, really cold and rainy, but
usually cold, usually warm weather and 4,000 horsepower.
Yes. Yes. And it is, it guys come down there and because of that, you know, it goes back to the warm weather, great racetrack. And Wes just promotes that race, you know, so big that, I mean, it's even hard for me to say worldwide, because that's where I come from. That's big. I mean, I'm used to East Coast, but when you say worldwide, and that's what he's done. I mean, you got guys coming from overseas running and all. It's just amazing.
And how many years is the event into right now?
I think this is the 8th year. He's had like 8 winners. He had it started out in Denver.
In Denver, right.
And then I guess he moved it to Florida, the weather, and I think Southern Florida is the perfect deal. Because
that was the right way to do it.
Yeah, so he moved it down there, and then when he went there, it just exploded.
Right.
You know, just, and it's not all about the purse. It really isn't. It's the competition. Every one of these guys, 83 guys there, okay, 150 to win. Don't get me wrong, it's a lot of money. But are they really there for the 150,000? They're there to try to beat the 83 guys that they know is the baddest cars in the world.
I like how you said that people aren't going there primarily just for the purse. I think Wes has successfully created the right atmosphere for it as well, moving it from Bandimere down to Bradenton at that time of the year. People are usually depressed at that time of the year. Now you're bringing them, getting everybody's blood pumping from being in the stands to being behind the wheel. And you have the right weather at that time of the year to be grilling at midnight and be in the stands at 7 a.m.
Yep.
It's, you know, everything is working for that event and the reason why it's going to continue to grow. And if anything, going to get more racers wishing to be on that invite list.
Yep. I'm sure Wes's phone rings off the hook that time of year.
right.
I'm sure he's getting a lot of text messages and stuff for everybody. Because, I mean, even the first year we got invited, we was one of the last ones to get invited.
Oh, really?
Not this year, but the year before. And some of it was because we didn't do a lot of social media. We didn't do, I mean, we ran well, and we ran a lot of like Northeast Pro Mod and stuff, but I say it's, you didn't get the amount of attention, right? I felt like we flew underneath the radar. So we was kind of, not that we wasn't good enough to be there, but you didn't create that. As Wes says it, you don't toot your own horn, ain't nobody going to toot your horn.
That's a actually very good topic to bring up right now, because you may have a fast car, you may be a great driver, but you're missing the other cards in the hand right now. You have to have a social media presence. You may need to be a better personality than you are a driver to be added to the 80 people who already get called. And it's kind of funny, before we sat down, I got text saying, Steve's actually new to this, but he's been doing a great job at it for the past year or two now. And from this conversation right here, it seems like you've been doing, you're used to being in front of this camera.
I'm trying.
Might be doing a little bit better than me and Nick are.
I got a pep talk coming in, so I'm good. But I never did social media. I mean, I'm 53 years old. It wasn't a thing. Yeah, do I look at Facebook? Some, yeah. But when we was racing, that I did not throw it out there.
You were more of a scroller than a content creator.
Correct.
Which is what the majority of people are.
Yep. And you know, we raced. Me and Jeff. I mean, I've been together with Jeff for 25 years, and we race. He's not into the tooting your horn and all that, and Jean's very, very similar. But Jess at ET Edits, she's Jean's daughter, but she came involved. And one of the races, like 2 years ago, year and a half ago, she's with her phone, like, oh, I'll do a little interview.
So can we credit her for the reason why you guys got invited to World Series of Pro Mod? Because without the social media, Wes would have been like, no.
Yeah, it did help. It really did help. And actually, Gene took that to another level, and he hasn't done it in a while, but he started creating where the car did a little talking. Like the bumper would move, and like he had an app or something.
Oh,
and,
like animating
and
it.
He would... Gene likes talking some shit and he likes getting the pot stirred up, and he let the car do it.
I like
but
it.
Then... We
let
went
your
through,
car do the talking.
Yeah, and we did a little, we went through a spell there where we wasn't doing very well with the one car. Not blaming the car, but we just didn't do well. We didn't win a lot of races with it. And so Gene stopped. He's like, we can't keep talking if we're not backing it up.
right.
You kind of look like the bully at school that bullies everyone, but you keep getting beat up.
That's right.
So once we got this other car really running well, and we've did some. Gene kind of gave us a little crap on a couple of them, but I never realized how much social media propels you.
100%.
I just never knew. She does it. We did a couple videos, and obviously with my accent, I'm from the country, you know, I'm out, but people like that. They really do.
They want to connect.
Yeah, it's really weird. I never knew. I just never knew it would grow. She's grew our deal so big that it's unbelievable. Just one smack talk video we did for Jason Harris on a little handicap scooter. And it blew up so big, PDRA's come to us. Man, y'all need to do more of that. Y'all,
yeah.
You know, they're pushing the envelope, because just like the World Series, if you're not on social media, every person that see me on social media may come there and watch that race. And I think that helps the sport. Because that might be the next drag racer there. That may be the next pro modified driver.
From a promoter's standpoint, you know, I have to wholeheartedly agree with that, because there's so much that a media outlet could do, that Drag Illustrated could do, and there's so much that the main promoter could do, like World Series of Pro Mod. Treating those as two different outlets, World Series its own outlet, Drag Illustrated as its own outlet. The way that the event grows and everyone grows is if the racers continue to push as personalities, your fan bases grow. Meaning, the more your fan bases grow, the more merch you could potentially sell. Those, your fans will potentially want to see you in person, might as well go to the biggest event in the history of racing to see you at. And again, meet other personalities as well. Like, oh, I didn't know who these 80 other guys were, because a lot of them didn't have social media before. But if we get more people like Jess who are able to evolve other people's race programs, like you said, I'm 53 years old. I'm not interested in learning the technology behind it. But if I get this 20-something year old who's willing to do it and I just have to be in front of the camera, then let's get it done.
Yep.
So notice to all other racers who have programs out there who are, you know, of a certain age that they don't want to learn the technology, you don't have to. Hire somebody who does know this, like the whole gang behind our cameras right now, because this new generation loves the technology and can help you evolve your program and take you to this new generation. Because how cool is it when people come up to you and we're like, Steve, I saw that post on social media. And then initially you're like, damn, I was nervous as hell making that.
Yep.
But knowing that that video got 100,000 views or whatever it may be, like, yeah, people are going to recognize you. And especially when you're at the track, can I take a picture with you? You know, can I buy your t-shirt? Can I get your autograph? And we need, honestly, every single racer out there that claims to do this as professionally to make that investment into this generation of content creators who know how to do this. And you just have to talk.
Yep.
And if you are nervous about talking, Steve will be a testament to say, so were you.
Yes.
And now you're getting as good as you are in front of the camera as you are a driver.
I've gotten better at this for sure.
There
trying.
You go.
She gives me hell all the time, and she gives me pointers too. So she helps some too.
Just there, like you practice for the tree. Yep, you got to.
You do.
All these little short reels and clips that you do are just making you better.
I think it brings spectators.
100%.
You know, yeah. I think it brings the spectators. Everybody wants the hero and the villain.
Yeah.
And you got to play one or the other
Someone's got to do the job.
And, you know, even.
So are you the hero or are you the villain?
I think I was the villain someone when we did the one video. And
he's like, I kind of liked it.
Yeah. It was Gene wants to. His videos with the car talking are pretty crude, and some people didn't like it, but it's funny, but it's crude.
Yeah.
And our videos wasn't that bad. We kind of kept them PG-13, but Jason Harris, we did that one video, and it's funny. He sends me a message. He says, hey, man, I got people calling me saying, who's this guy talking to? You want me to beat him up or what?
Yeah.
I'm like, and it's not in bad blood, but I think it creates that controversy. And social media, it just goes everywhere.
Yeah.
I just didn't realize how far it reached, you know, out into the people from Puerto Rico, everywhere come up. Man, we love your videos. We love your videos. So it tells you it's doing what, I don't like telling this, but she's doing a great job.
Doing a good job.
Right. And
there you go.
I just never knew.
Yeah.
Because it's not what I do. And we race. But when you go to World Series now, almost half the drivers have somebody following around with a camera now or doing interviews for them.
Yeah.
So
we need to get the 100% of the racers committed to that. So if you're if you're on the half that are not in front of social media right now, you need to make that investment. Find yourself a good content creator to get on your team. Add them to the budget.
Yep. Yep. And the old school guys don't.
I just want to race.
They don't get it. I mean, even like my crew chief, Jeff, I mean, he's came on board more. When he first, I said, man, that's bull. All that stuff's bull. You don't need to be, you ain't got time for that. But he sees what it does now. And I think it does move a lot of merchandise and it puts your face out there.
Yep.
Or the team.
And potentially whatever. Could get you more sponsors.
Yes. Correct. So it's big.
With that being said, you better shout out all your social media right now for everyone who isn't following you yet.
What are your social pages?
Pilot Racing on Facebook. And we're not on any of the other ones, are we? Are you on the other ones? She's on all the other ones. I don't even know. I don't even do it. I just look.
Jess is going to feed you from behind the camera right now. Yeah. Let him know what social media is.
We're on both of those.
What are the pages?
Is it the same handle?
Oh, just Pilot Racing on all of them then. Okay. So Pilot Racing on all
TikTok?
Of them.
TikTok?
Yeah. Pilot Racing, all one word.
Yep. She's grown it. She's grown that deal a lot.
So we need you to talk more shit on those pages, basically.
We do some. People love. We did one little video with Halsey with a little. Just it was wasn't even 20 seconds, was it? 30 seconds. We did one where I was actually at this little stream and act like I was fishing, and his nickname's Daddy Shark, and we was fishing, and people thought I just come home from racing and just was. I said, man, we're here enjoying ourselves today, and I said, oh, I think I got a fish, and. She probably got that video, and I reel up, and I got this little baby shark on the end of the pole, and I pulled up and said, oh, who's his daddy? And we cut it off and put the little glasses and the little cigar sticking out of my mouth on the video.
That's
so
funny.
And it got a lot of views. So just little stuff like that you do.
Keep it up. Yeah, you got to keep doing stuff like that.
You create that controversy. And just that's my biggest thing with social media. I think controversy sells.
It does. Yeah. We'll be seeing Jim Halsey next weekend. We have our own event that we're doing there, Fast Life Fest, no prep event. So very familiar with Cecil County Dragway.
Yep.
So we've got quite a week's worth of work ahead of us. And, I mean, on that note, we appreciate you coming. Like you said, you drove 5 hours to be on this podcast with us. And it shows your commitment to your racing program and your awareness to what, you know, this interview and social media does for the race program. And I think it's a, you know, a big flare up in the sky for other people who had that previous belief of, I just want to race. Like, cool. But Steve's a testament here of him saying, like, I used to think like that, but it's really not the case anymore.
I did. I probably wouldn't have did this 2 or 3 years ago.
Right? Would have gave that hard no. Yeah. 5 hours driving.
I ain't coming
to
up
talk
there, so.
In front of the camera.
Yep. And I'm glad I did, because I'm glad you guys do it, because it puts, I get the mean mug. I got this is what gets showed all the time, but it's also, it takes my whole squad to do it. And I'm big on making sure that that's put out there, because.
Giving everybody their flowers for their hard work.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it takes us all. And I can talk crap at night and give the other drivers crap, but at the end of the day, if we do good, I'm just the lucky guy that got to drive it. It took all those other guys to do it.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's things that people on the camera don't see, how much it takes 4, 5, 6 guys to do, and how much time and effort they put in and give up at home too to go do it.
How many more times are you going to be behind the wheel this year?
Probably 8, 9 times. We got the whole PDRA season, and then we'll run Jimmy's deal at Yellow Bullet.
September.
Yep, and then he's got an invitational deal that we won last year that we'll go back to.
October, right?
Yep.
Yep.
So we'll run those, and then we'll go right into the winter series again to try to.
Year's going to fly by.
Oh, it's going to go quick, because you just, it's so much work.
And now it's nonstop, right? Before there was a break, and now with the winter series, there is no
nonstop, and we're busy at work. So, you know, as soon as you get home, we go right straight to the job site and we work. And at night we do whatever, the motor homes, whatever. Thank goodness the race cars, John and them's taking care of that thing up there. And that took a big burden off of me and Jeff both, because there was a lot of time in the last 20 years that I spent away from home working on a race car. Like a lot, that I lost a lot of family trips and events that people don't see, that
right.
They don't know.
Sacrifice.
Yeah. I mean, I drove an hour one way every night, 6 nights a week to Jeff's house to work on my Viper and Camaro, and drove an hour home every night after work. I mean, I did that for a long time.
Wow.
But I had a sickness. I don't know how to spell it. I got a sickness with no rehab. There's no rehab for
this itch.
Yes.
Got this itch that don't scratch itself.
It don't. There's just no rehab for what these pro mods are insane. They really are.
I love it, man. Addicted to the horsepower. That's what we're all about here. Appreciate everybody for watching Eat Sleep Race podcast. Make sure you guys follow Steve King. And we're looking forward to staying tuned to Pilot Racing's pages, seeing how your year goes. Hopefully you do set that goal this year, or you do achieve that goal of winning that PDRA championship and running it back again next year at Winter Series.
That's what we're hoping, man. We got a good crew. You know, those guys they're badass. So we have a chance. I just got to go out there and drive the car.
That's right. And of course, we got to give a special shout out to Wes Buck, owner of Drag Illustrated and the Winter Series, for giving us the platform to meet Steve and the crew, to be able to have him as a guest today.
We greatly appreciate being here, too.
Awesome, man. We appreciate it. Till next time, guys.